From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Nicaraguan elections. Not all the votes are counted, but Somoza supporter Arnaldo Alemán is claiming victory over Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega. Who will take Congress? A look at House and Senate races as they tighten up around the country. And as the mainstream press slams the San Jose Mercury News series on the CIA and crack cocaine, we'll go back to the 1980s when the connection was first made. All that and more coming up with Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton detoured through New Jersey and New York in the home stretch of the White House race to raise millions of dollars for Democrats in the face of growing Republican criticism about accepting foreign political contributions. He urged supporters not to be overly complacent despite his strong lead. And Bob Dole is proposing the banning of all political contributions from foreigners. The Republican challenger continued to pound Clinton and the Democrats on the issue, charging they've laundered foreign money into the presidential campaign. On Friday, the Democrats suspended activities of a former Commerce Department aide who's been soliciting funds from Asian Americans, including close to $500,000 linked to Indonesia's Lippo Group, a group that is very close to the Suharto dictatorship. Vice President Al Gore is attempting to firm up core Democratic constituencies. He met with Hispanics and attended a black church in Chicago. He said you can make the critical difference, urging a minority get-out-the-vote effort at the United States Hispanic Leadership Conference. And Japan's liberal Democrats won the most seats in parliamentary elections. According to estimates by state TV, the LDP had taken 239 of the 500 seats in the Diet's lower house, short of outright control, but virtually certain to return Prime Minister Hashimoto to power. And you're listening to Democracy Now! With only 7% of the vote counted, right-wing candidate Arnaldo Alemán in Nicaragua claimed victory today in the presidential election. Alemán is expected to defeat his main rival, Daniel Ortega, former leader of the Sandinista government. Alemán campaigned on a fierce anti-Sandinista ticket. He said he would fight to return land to the Somocistas, the supporters of dictator Somoza that was confiscated from them after the Sandinistas came to power. And he said Ortega win would return Nicaragua to socialism and civil war. Joining us to talk about the results of the election, at least as we know them at this point, are Circles Robinson, who's lived in Nicaragua for 12 years working with the National Union of Farmers and Ranchers. He's the editor of Nicaraguan Farmers' View, an English-language publication on rural life and national issues. More people work in agriculture than in any other field. Nicaragua is one of the poorest countries in this hemisphere. He joins us from Managua. And we're also joined by Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, joining us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Circles Robinson, at this hour, what can you tell us about the Nicaraguan elections?
Well, I can first tell you that there's about 70 to 75% of the people turned out to vote, a little bit less than in 1990 when 86% turned out, but it was still a very high turnout. There were 2,421,000 registered voters. With the 7% that you mentioned, that comes to 113,000 valid votes, and Alemán, the candidate of the Liberal Alliance, has 48.68%, and Daniel Ortega, 39.58%. The elections were carried out under relatively good weather, and it was a calm day, and there was relatively no violence in the country.
This would indicate that Ortega got about the same percentage of the vote as he got 6 years ago.
Yes.
These results hold up.
In numbers, it will probably turn out to be somewhere between 50 and 100,000 more votes than he got in 1990.
But in percentage, it's going to be around the same.
Close to the same, correct.
Well, what does this say about the Sandinistas? Are they still the dominant unified political party in the country, or have they now been replaced by Mr. Alemán's party?
Well, in the National Assembly this time, Alemán's party and the Sandinistas are running closer than they are in the presidential election. And it's still much too early to say who will have more deputies in the National Assembly. Probably neither one will have an absolute majority. So the Sandinistas will still be a strong bloc in the National Assembly, but Alemán will probably have a few more seats and will be in a better position than the Sandinista opposition was. The UNO coalition, which fell apart shortly after the elections in 1990.
Circles Robinson, tell us a little about who this right-wing candidate is, Arnaldo Alemán, the mayor of Managua. What are his demands? What is he saying that he will institute when he becomes president, and where did he come from?
Well, Arnaldo Alemán comes from a family of coffee growers south of Managua in an area called El Crucero. His parents sent him to law school. He became a lawyer. He wasn't very much involved in politics until 1989, when with the farmers' organization called, it was called UPANIC, that he was a director of, he made some strong statements along with a couple other farmers against the Sandinista agricultural policy, and as a result, his property was confiscated. And that turned him into a very very strong anti-Sandinista. At that point in time, he joined what was the UNO coalition when it was being formed. He became their candidate for mayor of Managua, and his march towards the presidency began the first day that he was elected mayor, which was on February 25th, 1990.
Can we talk a little about the social situation now in Nicaragua? Because we hear a lot of coverage now, just for a few days probably, about the election, but we almost hear nothing about what's going on in the country. I've read statistics that there's something like a 60% unemployment rate now, and something like 70% of the people of the country live in poverty. When I was last there for 2 months in 1990 covering the election, the situation was bad for a lot of people, but it doesn't sound like it was that bad. What do you see as you go around the country, especially in the rural areas, as far as people's ability to feed and clothe and house themselves?
Well, Nicaragua is definitely suffering under the structural adjustment agreements that the Nicaraguan government made with the IMF and the World Bank. It required a great reduction of state spending, and since there was a lot of state employment during the 1980s, those jobs disappeared in the early 1990s. The 60% figure is unemployment or underemployment. There isn't a specific figure for employment. There's probably around over 30% unemployment, but there are many people in the country that only have work occasionally. It's meant in the countryside, it's meant a lack of investment funds for agriculture. So a lot of farmers have been reduced to being survival farmers. At the same time, the little investment money there has been in the country has gone mainly to import products from other countries. Those are the type of loans that the IMF and the Nicaraguan private banks that exist now believe are much less risky. They import something, they sell it, mainly geared towards about a 10 or 15% part of the population. And there's not a lot of money for creating employment. The only area that employment's increased in the cities in these last years is in the free trade zone where the maquila plants are. Nicaragua got started much later than the other Central American countries, but in the last 5 years they've built up the first 19 plants and there's 8,000 workers there. And both Alemán as a candidate and Daniel Ortega promised to maintain favorable conditions for that foreign investment.
Now, are those workers union? I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask: are those workers unionized, and what do they get paid?
No, they're not. They're not unionized, and unions, like in most of the free trade zones throughout Central America, are very highly discouraged. Usually, you're fired if you try to organize. The workers get paid somewhere between $60 and $100 a month, which is higher than some of the jobs that exist in Nicaragua. On the other hand, the employment conditions are extremely difficult. Forced overtime. We haven't had a lot of cases here reported of 14-year-olds working in those factories. It's mostly women in their 20s, with very hard conditions. A lot of times they don't have a place to eat. There's been factories here without a fire extinguisher in them and 1,000 sewing machines. Safety conditions are poor, but they are jobs. And in Nicaragua, both candidates in this election, both Daniel Ortega and Arnaldo Alemán, felt that anything that's a job at this point in time is better than nothing.
We're talking to Circles Robinson, who's lived in Nicaragua for 12 years, working with the National Union of Farmers and Ranchers. Some might have been surprised to hear you say that the fiery Sandinista leader and former president, Daniel Ortega, in fact, is favorable toward Western investment. In fact, that is the tone that he's adopted during this election. Now, despite that, when I've been going to the State Department briefings, Nicholas Burns, the State Department spokesperson, has been saying a lot about Daniel Ortega. He says he's a bad Democrat. He will not forget what he did during the 70s and 80s. And so although the U.S. claims to remain neutral, they clearly were putting out signals about who they wanted. What about Daniel Ortega and the route he has taken since the revolution, since they overthrew the dictator Somoza? I mean, I hear now that in this election, in fact, there were he was aligning himself with a number of Contra leaders as well.
Yes, well, the image of the campaign image of the Daniel Ortega campaign, the Frente Sandinista campaign, was one of great moderation, of realism, of what they consider the world, the changing world situation is. They did not economically differ very much from the proposals of the Alemán campaign. At the same time, they were making a lot of efforts to try and win over sectors. For example, in the Catholic Church, they made a big effort to try and convince the cardinal, who is a very important figure here in Nicaragua, probably the most important figure, to convince Cardinal Obando that they had changed, that they weren't going to have military service, that they were going to have good relations with the United States. They repeatedly told the population that the United States would recognize whoever won the elections. The U.S. ambassador 2 days ago here in Nicaragua, John Maisto, he repeated that, although he did say some ifs, and those ifs were if the elections they decided were democratic, if everybody had a fair chance to vote, et cetera, et cetera. In the last few days of the campaign, something you might not know about is that the cardinal, as well as the existing president, Violeta Chamorro, made a lot of signals in the last few days of the campaign to not trust Daniel Ortega. They came out very clearly that that he could not be trusted, that this was just a show, and that once in power, he might revert back to what they consider communist politics.
Back on that same point that Amy was just making, Circles Robinson, back in 1990, those of us who were covering the election suspected that the United States and other foreign governments were exercising a great deal of influence in that election. We saw all kinds of new vehicles appear, for example, driven by the UNO supporters, and a lot of propaganda being printed abroad, etc. And after the election, of course, we found out that millions of dollars had been spent from outside Nicaragua. A lot of it functioned through the USIA and the National Institute for Democracy, etc. Is there any indication this time that the United States and other foreign powers were interceding economically as they did in 1990 to influence the election?
Well, in the case of the United States recognizes that they've given $9 million through different organizations, through AID, USAID, for a number of organizations in Nicaragua that they say were designed to promote citizen participation. As far as there's also a number of other organizations from both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, which don't have to say what they're spending, the Nicaraguan government's electoral council has definitely been unable to keep track of what money is spent outside of the money that they give the political parties. They gave each political party, there was 24 of them, they gave them each about $250,000 for their campaign. But the two leading candidates, Alemán and Ortega, both spent several million. But you don't know where that money came from, and I don't think anybody's going to say.
What about... Go ahead, Larry.
I was wondering about the media this time. Again, when I was back there in 1990, the media was very badly split. The government-controlled television, which a lot of people watch, radio was more equitably divided, with each side having its own radio stations, and the newspapers were divided. How about this time? What kind of influence over the people does the national media hold, and who's running it these days?
Well, in the urban areas, television has definitely become the biggest media. They've privatized the number. There's a number of private stations now. The leading one that has 75% of the audience is the Channel 2. And that station, although it has talk programs that allow candidates from different political beliefs, the Sandinistas have been on the program, editorially, they were clearly in favor of Alemán. The Sandinistas have a television station of their own. It's Channel 4. I think it has about 10% of the 10-12% of the TV audience. And then there's a couple other private stations that were pro-Aleman. In the case of radio, radio, which is by far the most important thing in the rural areas, it's probably the most split. As to say, there's Sandinista stations and there was pro-Aleman stations that reach out into all the rural areas of the country. So they had their choice in those areas. The print media, there's four major newspapers in the country. Two, by the end of the campaign, two were in favor of Aleman. One was in favor of Daniel Ortega's ex-vice president, Sergio Ramirez, and Barikara, the Sandinista paper, was, of course, in favor of Ortega.
Let me ask you a few quick questions about a story that has been very big here, and I wanted to ask if it's big down there right now, and that is the issue of the CIA, crack cocaine, and the Contras. In the last segment of the show, we're going to be talking further about the San Jose Mercury News series and all that has happened since it came out in August. But how has it played there? And also, I noticed that President Jimmy Carter is down there leading the delegation that's observing the elections, and with him is former Secretary of State James Baker, there, of course, Secretary of State in the Reagan-Bush years. Well, he was one who might well know what the story is about. Is this getting any play in Nicaragua?
Well, when the articles came out in the San Jose Mercury, shortly after they were reprinted here, they were translated and reprinted here in most of the newspapers. So there was coverage of them. I think it's a subject that didn't become one of great public discussion very much because it's something that people just assumed before. It was assumed way back from the Iran-Contra hearings that drugs were going to the United States from Central America to help finance the Contra and buy them weapons, and that was kind of assumed. And whether the issue in the United States, of course, at the beginning of crack and in the neighborhoods in Los Angeles, etc., is a bigger issue in the United States than it is here. I think it's almost a moot point here. It's something that people... most people knew happened, and there's really, it's not as big a deal.
Under wild capitalism, as they call it, one of the things that happens in countries like Nicaragua is that drug dealing takes off big time. There were allegations that there was some under the Sandinistas, but it was never really proven. Has that happened in the last 6 years, and is the Aleman government allied with any of that, either transshipment or increased usage domestically of drugs in Nicaragua?
Well, the end of the militarization of Nicaragua, because the war ended in 1990, and the reducing of the army and the patrols on the coast drastically, the army was reduced from over 80,000 to down to about 16,000, I believe now, basically left things open for drug trafficking. It's to say the ability for the army to patrol is considerably less, and that's enough to let more drugs be passing through Nicaragua, and there has been, from the little bit that's been captured, it's obvious that drugs are passing through the country. I can't give you an idea how that would rank with other Central American countries or South American countries, probably a lot less still. Consumption in the country is probably less than in any other place in the area, but it's definitely growing. And some of the young people that came back from Miami that were used to using drugs in the United States also brought their habits back to Nicaragua, and they're using them here.
Circles Robinson, what about this? This one of the things that the what looks like the new president of Nicaragua has called for, and that's the returning of land that the Sandinistas took after the revolution, the Somoza land and allies of Somoza. Now, is it true that Daniel Ortega himself is living on confiscated land, and what would this mean for the people of Nicaragua, and why would they go along with it?
Well, the idea of returning property is not exactly what he's saying. He's saying two things at the same time. He's saying he's going to legalize the land of the people who are on confiscated land, and he's saying he's going to compensate the people who were the previous owners, which is pretty much the same as Violeta Chamorro has said, and pretty much the same as the FSLN wants to do. The problem is the money in that case. And the reason Violeta Chamorro was not able to resolve the property question was she wasn't able to come up with the money to pay the amount that the people who were confiscated in the 1980s felt their properties were worth. The idea of Aleman violently throwing people off the land is something that concerns Sandinistas, and there are many people who voted for Daniel Ortega out of fear of Alemán, although in the same way many people voted for Alemán in fear of the Sandinistas. But back to the property, many poor people who receive land in the countryside or lots in the city are afraid of that. But the question is whether, with a very strong Sandinista opposition, which will be very close to almost half, almost as many seats as Alemán in the National Assembly, and an army that's not willing at this point to be the executor of those evictions, I don't really personally think that Alemán will go ahead and try something like that. I think he'll try and get some money to compensate the owners. And there will be some cases, like Daniel Ortega's house, for example, which he's used before to make a big deal about. Daniel Ortega's on a house that was confiscated from the campaign manager of the Alemán campaign. They were there on the stage last night when Alemán was proclaiming himself victory. He's the godfather of Alemán. And it remains to be seen whether Alemán would make some symbolic gestures like trying to get Daniel Ortega to have to give his house back. But as far as poor people that have been living on the property for 10 or 15 years, they're not going to give it up peacefully, and I'm not so sure that Alemán really wants to confront that.
Well, Circles Robinson, I want to thank you very much for joining us again. Circles Robinson, who works with the National Union of Farmers and Ranchers, speaking to us from Managua today. Again, results coming in from the Nicaraguan elections held yesterday, and it looks like at least with 7% of the vote in, that right-wing populist Arnaldo Alemán has claimed victory in the elections, and we will keep people updated on that if there are any changes. You're listening to Democracy Now! In the last segment of the show, we're going to be taking a look at further developments involved with the revelations from the San Jose Mercury News. We'll be speaking with John Mattis and Dennis Bernstein. But up next, we'll go around the country looking at House and Senate races with Larry Bensky. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Pacifica Radio's Larry Bensky out at KPFA in Berkeley. And we're going to take a look at the House and Senate races right now. It does look like that Bill Clinton, now pretty sure of victory, unless something comes up at the last minute, is actually going out and campaigning for Democrats. And Bob Dole is still campaigning for himself, Larry. And it looks like there are a number of Senate and congressional candidates who actually don't want him or Jack Kemp. I know in New York this has been the case, and in New Jersey certainly. Don't want them around very much in terms of the kind of connections people are going to make with a failed party.
Well, the person they really don't want around is Newt Gingrich in any kind of marginal race, because, of course, he has extremely high negatives and tends to conduct himself in an abrasive and arrogant manner, which is the last thing in the world that Republican candidates want. Yeah, Amy, more and more attention is now being focused on the House and Senate races, and we'll be doing that also in this program increasingly now with just 2 weeks before the election. It would seem as if the situation has really remained unchanged from what I did say and would have said 6 months ago, that the Democrats have a fairly decent chance of taking over the House of Representatives by just a few seats, and a less possible chance of taking over the Senate. I just spent the last 3 days driving around one of the largest congressional districts in the United States preparing for a report that people will hear later this week on this program, the first congressional district in California. This is one of the most volatile districts in the country. It's changed hands 4 times in the last 4 elections, going back and forth from Democrats to Republicans, and it's rated a toss-up this time as well. And what I can tell you from having spent all that time going 500-plus miles in a car in 3 days around this huge district, which stretches from the northern San Francisco suburbs all the way to the Oregon border, is that something that I've also seen in the rest of the country is true, and that is that there's a real serious public disconnect from this whole electoral process. In the entire time that I was out for 3 days in those 550-some-odd miles, I didn't see one single house sign on anybody's lawn for either of the candidates. I saw plenty of signs for the candidates, but they were always on public lands or interchanges of freeways or tacked up on phone poles. I also did not see one single bumper sticker for either of the candidates other than on the bumpers of people who attended their political rallies. So in other words, outside of the small circle of the convinced and those who are out there nailing signs up on phone poles, I didn't see any enthusiasm in the groundswell of the public. The other thing, 2 things to note are, this race, which is just one congressional race, the 2 candidates will have raised probably between $2.5 and $3 million before this race is over. That's about 3 times what they both raised. They didn't run against each other, but the 2 candidates in this race raised the last time. And the final thing is that much of this money is being spent on television ads, and the television ads, especially on the part of the incumbent Republican Frank Riggs, are extremely dirty. They are hitting at his opponent for being inexperienced, too young, not having voted in elections, and especially an ad which Riggs's campaign didn't pay for, but the Republican National Committee paid for, which is a sample of an ad that they run all around the country, tries to portray her as a tool of big labor bosses because the AFL-CIO has been running ads against him in the district. The Republican National Committee spent $400,000 running negative ads on Michaela Alioto, the candidate in that district, a 28-year-old young woman who was a former aide to Al Gore, calling her a tool of big labor. And this is a clone of the ads that the Republicans are running in several dozen other districts around the country.
You know, Larry, I wonder if the kind of demobilizing, if there is a real demobilizing effect from the concentration on TV ads. I mean, we were talking with Bob Henley a while back, a reporter who reports with the New York Times and the Village Voice in New York and other publications, who's been following the races. And he continually points out this issue that around 17% or 18% of the money that goes into the TV campaigns are kicked back to the political consultants. So their whole effort is to put money into TV ads and not into grassroots organizing. And that, in the, just like when we sit on watch TV, we're couch potatoes, that overall it has a demobilizing effect and people are not organizing.
I think there's no question about that. But also the fact that the political parties in this country really aren't political parties in the sense that even the Sandinistas are, that we were just talking about, or Arnaldo Alemán's party. You can't go to a Democratic Party headquarters in most places in the United States and get anything done or find out anything. In fact, there are no headquarters except at election times when they rent some vacant storefronts and fill it full of volunteers and telephones. So there is no organized major political party presence in people's lives here, as there are in many European and Latin American democracies. It is just an ad hoc group that comes together around election time. And the spending on television, of course, is a major factor. Somebody asked me the other day whether I thought Bob Dole would really contest California, and I said, well, he may not want to contest it, but his consultants certainly do, because that's how they get paid. If the ads don't run, then the ad agencies don't get paid, then the television stations don't get paid, then the people who make the commercials don't get paid. Electoral politics is a major industry in this country, with now, I think, Ellen Miller and the Center for Responsive Politics say it's going to be $1.6 billion spent this time on that election. That's a lot of money.
It's absolutely incredible. The Republicans already claiming victory in terms of fundraising. In the last 3 months, they've raked in over $92 million. I think Democrats about half of that, $46 million. What about the way the AFL-CIO's ads are playing around the country? You talked about them in California. I mean, you have them putting in around $35 million into these ads. It's the first time we've seen big labor organized in this way and really getting out there. I've heard in a few places that the Republicans have been able to turn it around and say, you know, these guys are candidates of a big machine. In the end, do you think it's going to help or hurt?
I think it's definitely going to help the candidates that, because you can tell that from the reaction to it, Amy, that the Gingrich people would not have been reacting so strongly against these ads if they hadn't drawn blood. And they have drawn blood in many districts, not only here in the 1st Congressional District in California, but many other close districts around the country. For example, Gary Franks in Connecticut, the one of two African-American Republicans in Congress, his district up around Waterbury, they've been running ads against him. Peter Torkelson in Massachusetts, Martin Hoke in Ohio, who's being run against by Dennis Kucinich, the former mayor of Cleveland.
Right, who we had on the show.
Right. All of these are districts with very heavy union memberships. And when you have heavy union memberships, 25, 30, 35% of the potential eligible electorate in union families, these are men and women and children in families that belong to labor unions, you can expect a very heavy mobilization by labor. Now, the Republicans are charging that this is a tax on labor, that the union dues were raised against people, on union members in order to pay for this campaign. But the fact of the matter is that the average union member in the United States, the assessment comes out to 15 cents a month. That's what this advertising campaign is costing. And it didn't take a raising of union dues in order to do it. However, it is true that between 20 and 40% of labor unions members have voted, most recently in 1994, Republican, and that they might have something to say about their dues being used to advocate for Democrats. What the labor union's answer is, sure, well, if the Republicans come around to a pro-labor stance, we'd be happy to back them as well. And in many cases, this is true here in this first district, Frank Riggs, who's the conservative Republican incumbent, who's challenged very strongly now by this young woman, Michaela Alioto, he was allowed by Congress, this is interesting, to put his name on the minimum wage bill when they raised the minimum wage the other week and President Clinton signed it. Riggs was one of the sponsors of that bill, despite the fact that he'd voted six times against similar measures or on procedures similar measures in previous years. He was against it until it became clear that in his district it wasn't going to be a very good thing to be against the minimum wage, and it would be better if he had his name for it. So he switched around, and now he says, I advocated for poor people, and I helped sponsor the minimum wage. It's this kind of flip-flop that needs to get into the public discourse. Unfortunately, there is no public discourse. In a district like this, one that I spent time in this weekend, there are seven different newspapers. There are television stations that cover pieces of the area, but not all of it. Same thing with radio stations. So the candidates have to rely on their own propaganda to get the message out, and that propaganda is increasingly distrusted by the public.
We're talking to Larry Bensky about the races. Larry, I've been looking at some of the Senate races around the country, 10 very tight races that we're looking at. In Massachusetts, Senator John Kerry versus William Weld, they're virtually neck and neck, Kerry a slight bit ahead, the Weld's picking up. Of course, you've got New Jersey featuring the big bucks, Donnybrook, as they say, between House members Dick Zimmer and Robert Torricelli, probably the most expensive race in the entire country. Robert Torricelli slightly ahead, but Dick Zimmer moving up quickly with a really one of the nastiest ads in the country. It looks like an actual news broadcast that places like CBS have now put a disclaimer on to say this is not a news broadcast, saying that he was involved with a federal fugitive. He had actually helped take care of her daughter. This is a South Korean contributor who left the country supposedly reneging on something like $30 million worth of loans. He helped his 15-year-old daughter, and the question is, why didn't he know that this guy was a federal fugitive? fugitive. He says he didn't. But anyway, it's said in a news broadcast type way. You've got Clinton's home state of Arkansas, Congressmember Tim Hutchinson, the Republican, battling Attorney General Winston Bryant. As a man we know well in South Dakota, Senator Larry Pressler, who's in an increasingly serious trouble. Well, we'll see what happens with that one, although he is outspending the other candidate by many, many, many fold.
Well, the other candidate in that race is interesting because Tim Johnson, who's the other candidate, is the Democratic Congress member for South Dakota. And South Dakota is one of those states that has only one member of Congress. So, in effect, it's like a third senator. This guy Johnson runs statewide for his office. So he's very well known as well. Getting back to the television ads, Amy, it's really interesting how absolutely disgusting they can get. The one you talked about, out here in California, we have the infamous kidnapper and murderer of a 12-year-old girl, Richard Allen Davis, who was sentenced to death the other week. Four Republican candidates are now trying to identify their Democratic opponents with Richard Allen Davis, the kidnapper and murderer of this 12-year-old girl, including Frank Riggs, who's running an ad against Michaela Alioto, saying that because she is against the death penalty, she would be responsible for somebody like Richard Allen Davis walking free. And it's even worse in the district of Vic Fazio, a Democrat who's under attack by a very conservative Republican, Tim LaFever, and that's up here near Sacramento. In that one, they actually have the face of Vic Fazio morphing into that of Richard Allen Davis, the kidnapper and murderer, saying that because Fazio voted once in 1977 in the California Assembly against the death penalty, he would be the same type of person as Richard Allen Davis. Now, there's been a lot of indignation against this type of advertising, which is clearly unethical, even under the vague ethical codes that run these people's minds that make these things. But, you know, we're talking about sophisticated people who read newspaper editorials or listen to broadcasts like this one or even watch, you know, CNN or C-SPAN where they deconstruct ads. What is the net effect on people who are only very marginally involved in the electoral process mentally to see this kind of disgusting advertising? Does it work? Well, clearly Republican consultants believe in their focus groups and polling that this type of ad does work, or they wouldn't be using it. And that brings up the whole question of campaign reform, to which we have a late convert now, Bob Dole. I can't almost not even complete a sentence when I think about Bob Dole as a campaign reformer. But
it is pretty astounding. In fact, the headline in the Washington Post today, Dole outlines changes for political financing, and he has a whole list of things. He's calling for abolishing large contributions from corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals that are a major
ludicrous
source of revenue. I think he's gotten
ludicrous
something right. Although, I think what's significant here is that maybe at the end of all this, and with all of this turning around, the Democrats attacking the Republicans, Republicans attacking the Democrats, and either one of them is, each one of them is making more money than the next. Out of this is maybe a beginning of some kind of revolution. Maybe that's possible at the end of this. People's disgust will just finally not be able to be contained anymore.
Maybe, but it's going to take some real leadership, and I don't see that coming from either party. But the thing about the political ad, just to finish with that, is that at some point there really is going to have to be a board or authority that passes on the acceptability of what can be put on television as political advertising and on radio and in newspapers, what is completely off the charts, unethical, and destructive to the public mentality, and what isn't. And, of course, you run up strongly against the First Amendment, and the people who scream First Amendment most strongly about this are the very campaign consultants, television and radio stations and newspapers that make all the money off it. So we have a real serious, serious problem here, and it remains to be seen how, in this election, these negative ads really play out.
Well, we've talked about negative ads, and we've talked about a lot of big money. And, of course, these races are going on around the country. I mean, at this point, while Gingrich is saying there's no question that the Republicans will win, and we would expect him to say that, I mean, even he himself in Georgia always actually is in quite a tight race. Each time he's won, he has not won by that much. And in addition to him in Georgia, of course, you have Cynthia McKinney, who's in an uphill race, although she certainly pulled out in the Democratic primary, won far more than many people predicted. She is going to have a tough time, though it's not a definite loser for her in Georgia.
Well, her father managed to stick his foot in her mouth, and that probably is really going to hurt her by making anti-Semitic remarks about her Republican opponent, and she has since disassociated herself from her father's remarks, but that has become a tremendous tempest down there for Cynthia McKinney and may mean trouble for her. Around the country, these are really being fought now, Amy, on a lot of local issues, but the big thing the Democrats are trying to do is scream Medicare cutbacks and invoke the specter of Newt Gingrich. And if either of those has any kind of anchor in the population, we could see the Democrats really taking back the House of Representatives. The Senate's going to be a lot more difficult. In addition to the races you just mentioned, we have Paul Wellstone in Minnesota, who seems to be pulling away now, but is still in a very close race. We have an open seat in Colorado, where a Republican may continue to hold the seats for the Republicans. We have a number of contests like that around the country that are in play. What's happened here in California is interesting because we have 52 congressional seats, the largest in the country, and I was saying a few months ago that I thought maybe 5 or 6 were in play. Now we have as many as 10, but they aren't all seats that Democrats can take from Republicans. There may be 6 that Democrats can take from Republicans and 4 that Republicans could take from Democrats. If the Democrats do win back the House, one of the interesting rumors that's running around Washington now, Amy, is that Newt Gingrich would resign because he really doesn't want the Ethics Committee to continue to look into his campaign financing scandals. And if Bob Dole is a complete hypocrite and a late convert to campaign finance reform, that goes triple for Newt Gingrich.
Well, we do have to wrap up, but I did just want to mention the Texas race between Phil Gramm and Victor Morales. The latest ads of Phil Gramm attacking Morales on the issue of affirmative action. The ad was produced by Alex Castellanos. Many people know him, the media consultant who created the very controversial anti-affirmative action spot for North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. And at the same time, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee is not being a lot of help to Victor Morales, giving him about $100,000, but that is nowhere near and what, of course, Phil Gramm has, the man who's got the probably among the deepest pockets in all of the Senate.
Castellanos also produced those ads in California, that Richard Allen Davis ones that I was talking about before, but Morales did get some help recently. He was endorsed by the Texas Reform Party, and that could help him.
Well, we do have to get out of here now. We want to thank you very much, Larry Bensky, joining us from Berkeley Station KPFA. Coming up next, we're going to take a further look at the CIA crack connection. You're listening to Democracy Now. We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. The Los Angeles Times published a report yesterday saying that the Central Intelligence Agency did not introduce crack cocaine into Los Angeles's black community. In August, the San Jose Mercury News published a series of investigative reports by Gary Webb, revealing that the CIA allowed a Nicaraguan drug network to sell cut-rate crack cocaine in the United States because profits from the drug trade were helping arm the Nicaraguan Contras. The LA Times, however, said its investigation, which included interviews with officials, drug dealers, and researchers, showed that crack cocaine was already flourishing in South Central long before Nicaraguan traffickers were on the scene. The paper also said it found no evidence of significant drug profits were sent to Contra rebels. We're joined now by investigative journalist Dennis Bernstein. He's at KPFA. He's long studied official support for the drug trade. And we're joined on the telephone by John Mattis, former federal public defender and Senate investigator for Senator John Kerry. Yes, in that very tight race now in Massachusetts. Mattis was debriefing key witnesses who later testified before the Kerry Committee in the 1980s. Dennis, why don't we begin with you? It's not only the Los Angeles Times that's hitting hard on the San Jose Mercury News series done by Gary Webb. Today there's a big piece in the New York Times, and of course the Washington Post did a series of pieces. What's going on here?
Well, Amy, it seems that the L.A. Times and the New York Times is now mimicking the piece, the hit piece done by Walter Pincus, which came out on October 4th, ironically 10 years to the day that Hassan Fuss was shot down over Nicaragua. With Hassan Fuss was a man by the name of Sawyer, who was seen in Colombia by an FBI informant as a part of a cocaine shipment, loading cocaine on a CIA proprietary airline headed for the United States. This story, by the way, is very interesting. I'm looking at a New York Times piece, one of the very few that came out contemporaneously with the war in 1986, and written by Joel Brinkley. And here he says that he's writing, officials from several agencies said, and this is 1986, that Drug Enforcement Administration's office in Guatemala had compiled convincing evidence that the Contra military supply operation was smuggling cocaine and marijuana. And the fact is, if you just look at the San Jose Mercury News story, what you see is the end of a network that we reported on and John Mattis revealed over 10 years ago, which included extensive information about a major drug trafficking operation operating out of Ilopango Airport. It was surveilled by former DE agent Celerino Castillo III. Castillo noted in a memorandum that Oliver North had hired many drug traffickers to work with him in terms of shipping weapons to the Contras and providing drugs in the United States for sales. We have information from Colombia, from El Salvador. In Costa Rica, you had the CIA Central American Task Force chief saying that the Costa Rican Contra Southern Front was run with the support of cocaine provided by Manuel Noriega. That's Alan Fire, Central American Task Force chief. So you have a CIA high official, you have a DEA agent, you have memorandum that relates to what was going on in Costa Rica, El Salvador, and John Mattis comes in a very interesting place. He is a public defender at the time in Miami, and maybe we can go there and ask John, what were the things that you were observing and what convinced you that there was this illegal operation going on and that it was supported by narcotics trafficking? John, you began to investigate in the mid-1980s. John Mattis.
John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hi. In 1985, I began an investigation that was the Contra infrastructure here in South Florida. And that Contra infrastructure was plagued with narcotics traffickers. And in fact, that infrastructure, as identified by FBI memorandum at the time, quote, profits from the sale of narcotics were being used to finance the Contras. That's an FBI memorandum in 1985. So the United States government knew as early as 1985 that the Contras were involved in narcotics shipments. As early as 1986, Senator Kerry's staff began with me an investigation in Central America and Costa Rica around the southern United States of witnesses who provided direct testimony as to the links between narcotics traffickers and the Contras and the fact that none of these people were being prosecuted. And that's what's the key here. None of the people were being prosecuted.
John, it would be good to get to that, but talk a little bit about, you debriefed some of the key people who testified before the Kerry Committee. Talk about what you learned from people like Jorge Morales. Remind people who he was and what he was telling you and what kind of documentation he had to support it.
Well,
Jorge Morales was a cartel leader from Bogota who was under indictment here in South Florida for running a continuing criminal enterprise, shipping tons of cocaine into South Florida. And what he testified to, and publicly, I might add, was startling. He testified that, in fact, beginning in 1984, he was approached by Contra leaders Octaviano Cesar and Popo Chamorro of the Southern Front, CIA assets, and they asked him to go into the cocaine trade with them to help them ship cocaine into the United States, and he agreed to supply them guns and that they would supply him tons of cocaine and that it would be shipped out of Costa Rica with the protection of this national security veil that they had.
Now, and in 1984, consistent with that, there was a 1984 Miami Police Intelligence Memorandum that named some of the key early players in the Contra network. They talked about illegal training camps in Miami. By the way, this is when Janet Reno is the chief state prosecutor in charge of drug interdiction, and this memorandum was stamped, seen by George Kaczynski of the FBI. How does that fit into the structure?
Well, where that fits is that that memorandum, at the same point in time Morales says he was recruited by the Contras, that memorandum says the Contras themselves and their infrastructure were engaged in narcotics trafficking, and that the narcotics trafficking was coming out of Costa Rica, exactly where Morales says the Contras were based.
Now, this is the beginning of the cover-up, isn't it, John Mattis? This is where the Justice Department apparently began getting interested and then began to cover up the situation. In fact, you were in Costa Rica when a Justice Department official was there investigating. Could you talk about the beginning of the Justice Department investigation and then what happened and how Mr. William Weld, who's now running against Kerry, comes into the picture?
Well, what's so interesting about the disclosures that we were uncovering in the spring of 1986 were that the FBI knew about this. The FBI had their own memorandums about the drug trafficking coming out of Costa Rica. The FBI had its own memorandums about the gun running. And so it was nothing new to them. What was new, I guess, was the proposition that they might, in fact, have to indict these people for the ongoing narcotics trafficking. And when they were confronted with the reality that we were putting witnesses in front of them and suggesting that they go forward with investigations and turn those investigations into a grand jury and ultimately indictments, there was a decision made here in South Florida that that should not happen. And that decision carried over into the fall of 1986 when William Weld became the head of the criminal division for the whole Justice Department all over the United States. And it's at that point in time that Senator Kerry, personally frustrated by the inability of law enforcement here in South Florida to move ahead with an investigation, took his staff recommendations, his staff findings, and witness proffers directly to William Weld. And on September 26, 1986, sat down with William Weld and said, "I want you to prosecute, I want you to investigate, I want you to move ahead on the following issue." And a memorandum written on that day relates that Kerry disclosed to William Weld violations of gun running, neutrality, drug running by the Contras and their infrastructure. And it is that moment in time that William Weld had the opportunity to do the right thing. He had the opportunity to move ahead and convene grand juries.
And yet he didn't.
He did not.
You know, this is quite amazing because if you look at the race that's going on right now in Massachusetts, extremely tight between now Governor, Republican Governor William Weld, and Senator John Kerry, Democrat, Weld continually is hitting Kerry on the issue of drugs. But I've never seen Kerry in one of the debates, and they've had a series of debates over the last few months, raise this issue or raise his expertise, knowledge of drugs coming into this country as a result of CIA and Contra involvement. Never once has he talked about the Kerry Commission and what he did in the 1980s.
I think there's a politeness in the race. In fact, the media have talked about the politeness. Well, politeness
not much more.
Is one thing, but the truth is another. The truth is that William Weld was part of an infrastructure at the Justice Department that conducted a massive cover-up of cocaine illegalities poisoning our cities.
And let's point out here, Amy, this is Dennis Bernstein, and we're talking with John Mattis there. Let's point out that the Costa Rican government had started its own investigation at the time and provided extensive material that CIA asset John Hull and that the Oliver North Network, including Oliver North, John Puentex, Joe Fernandez, the CIA station chief, had become involved in a major drug trafficking operation that had created a cocaine problem for the first time in Costa Rica, which is why CIA asset John Hull was indicted by the Costa Rican government at the time for drug trafficking operations. And to this day, John Hull, John Poindexter, Oliver North, and others are not allowed to return to Costa Rica because of creating this drug scourge in Costa Rica.
So what is extraordinary is that in the fall of 1986, before Hassenfuss is shot out of the sky, a United States senator with his staff goes to the head of the criminal division of the Justice Department and lays out a complex conspiracy of drug running, gun running, and neutrality violations by the Contras and their supporters, and William Weld chooses to do nothing.
And right now, we're seeing a series of hit pieces in the Boston Globe. The most recent one, Friends gave Kerry cut-rate lodging deal. Senator says disclosure not required, about how Kerry in the 1980s, after his divorce, was going from basically lobbyist to lobbyist, staying at their homes, not paying them very much money. And why didn't he report this? Because weren't they doing him favors then, which he would have to return? Do you know about these articles and who has written them?
Yes. Those articles are generated by the Boston Globe, the same Boston Globe that sent a reporter with us to Costa Rica, into the prisons, and that same Boston Globe reporter heard the disclosures about the CIA, the NSC's involvement in the Contras, and the involvement of narcotics traffickers. Now, you need to go back and look. What has the Boston Globe said about narcotics trafficking in the Contras? What did it say in 1987? And let's move to 1987, when William Weld was again still running the criminal division of the Justice Department. Jorge Morales goes before the United States Senate under oath on C-SPAN, testifies and discloses the name of the Contra leaders whom he associated with and shipped tons of cocaine with into the United States. And the question is, what did William Weld do with that disclosure? Did he take the time to walk those 10 blocks over to the United States Congress and listen? Or did he even so much as pick up the phone and ask for a copy of the transcript, or suggest perhaps that he might want to meet the witness or convene a grand jury or begin an investigation of these Contra leaders? He, again, did nothing. He couldn't find it in his busy schedule to go and listen to sworn testimony by a cartel leader about the Contras being able to ship tons of cocaine into the United States, poisoning our cities.
And if he didn't want to believe a former drug dealer or a drug dealer, he could have talked to Celi Castillo, a highly decorated DEA agent whose job it was to interdict drugs in Guatemala and El Salvador. Mr. Castillo provided much memorandum and much information about the number of drug traffickers hired by the North Network, hired by Oliver North, these drug traffickers with DEA files, which Castillo listed in his various memorandum to whoever he could contact, his supervisors, special prosecutor, attorney general, Justice Department. The DEA worked for the Justice Department. The DEA worked for Mr. Weld, and yet Celi Castillo was never interviewed, he was never talked to, his information was never listened to. So there does appear here an unwillingness to cover up the situation. Amy, can I make a statement about these hit pieces?
Go ahead.
The first hit piece came out was written by Walter Pincus, and as far as I can see, it was mimicked by the LA Times and by the New York Times, which suggested that the Contras weren't the only drug traffickers dealing in cocaine. But that wasn't the point of the Mercury News article. It was talking about a major trafficking operation that included Contra operatives who were trained, supervised, and micromanaged by the CIA. This piece, the first piece, appeared in the Washington Post.
Dennis, we have 30 seconds.
written by Walter Pincus, who identified himself in 1967 in an article called How I Traveled Abroad on CIA Subsidy as a CIA conduit. So Walter Pincus was reporting to the CIA in 1967. What I want to know, is he still working for the CIA?
Well, we do have to wrap up, and we're going to have to leave it on that question, except 10 seconds to ask John Mattis, the editor of the San Jose Mercury News, said, the principal thing I would change about the San Jose Mercury News is we got to the door of the CIA. He says he would have emphasized this. We did not get inside the CIA.
What did the CIA know, and when did they know it, and what did they do about it?
Well, this is the question we'll have to leave this on, and of course, we'll continue to pursue it. John Mattis, we want to thank you for joining us, former federal public defender and Senate investigator for John Kerry, and want to thank very much Dennis Bernstein for joining us, who's been investigating this for more than a decade. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!